live from the beautiful Double Wide Studios overlooking Phoenix and heard worldwide. It's Clarity from Chaos with Dave Campbell. Dave and weekly guests examine, discuss, and offer insight into some of life's most complex challenges. So sit back and enjoy your one-hour journey out of chaos and into clarity. And now, your host, the real, the authentic, the one and only, Dave Campbell. We don't
get through the game. Good evening, all you rebels out there. Well, the day has finally arrived. The debate on the Article 5 convention issues is tonight, and it's upon us. I'm going to go briefly over the way the format's going to work tonight, just so you can understand. Then I will introduce the two that are going to be debating the issues. We're not going to have a commercial break. I will be asking questions during the debate, and we will go. We'll proceed from there. Now the rules of this debate are as follows. The questions that I've developed were brought forward out of Mr. Trent England, who's one of the debaters tonight's interview on the Daily Caller, and it basically surrounded five topics. Constitutional amendments are not the solution. They play into the current liberal dialogue. They are easy to stop. No one knows how an actual convention would work, and constitutionalism, a needed renewal of respect for the Constitution. Now, the two that are going to be debating tonight are Mr. Trent England. Now, Trent is currently the director of Save Our States Project, which is part of the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs and Liberty Foundation for America, located in Oklahoma City. Trent was formerly the executive vice president at the Freedom Foundation, Olympia, Washington, a legal policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. He's a licensed attorney and practices law in Washington. Our other debater is Mr. Bill Walker. He's been a leader in the Article 5 convention movement for over 20 years. His achievements include filing the first two federal lawsuits in United States history, directly dealing with the refusal of Congress to call an Article 5 convention, and gathering for the first time in United States history a collection of the actual applications by states for a convention call. The 746 applications from 49 are currently viewable on Bill's website, which is www.foavc.org. Bill has written nearly 600 articles on various aspects of the Article 5 convention and has spoken at both Harvard and the Thomas M. Cooley Law Schools. Now, those are the two debaters, and the way this is going to work is there's going to be an opening statement by Trent, a cross-examination by Bill, an opening statement by Bill, a cross-examination by Trent, and then we will go into the questions asked. Speakers will be allowed 30 seconds to finish a sentence. Once time is called, if time is called during cross-examination, the question answer goes unanswered. Questionnaires may stop the speaker to ask the next question during cross-examination. Again, all responses are expected to have, and this is important, supporting references cited. There's not going to be allowed any anecdotal comments about this or that. We want references so the people listening have an actual reference point that they can go to. So, with all of that said, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to get this debate started. I would like to introduce to you Mr. Trent England and Mr. Bill Walker. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening.
How are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Oh, good. Okay, Trent, it looks like you won the coin toss. So let's get this party started and go ahead with your opening statement.
Well, thank you so much, Dave, for hosting this conversation. And I think I want to start off by pointing out that I'm not an opponent of Article 5. And I think that that sometimes this gets misunderstood. I'm a skeptic about claims to the silver bullet solutions, and I'm cautious about any form of constitutional change. Whichever Article 5 path we go down, I think that there are There's really nothing more important than our Constitution to preserving our republic. And for that reason, I think when we think about changing our Constitution, we should do so with as much prudence as we can muster. But as to Article 5, I'll go through my 5 points you mentioned in my Daily Caller interview on this topic. And the first one is that it's not a solution. It's not a solution for this reason. If the problem that we have is that judges and politicians are not being faithful to the text of the Constitution, changing the text of the Constitution on its face isn't really a solution. And I understand that it's a way to push back against the courts, and we might win some sort of a short-term reprieve. But again, if the text is not the problem, if judges and politicians are the problem, then we're unlikely to solve that problem simply by changing the text. Second, the left stands to gain very much more, even by the conversation about constitutional change. Think of it this way. The American public is out there, and for a century, it has been conservatives who stand up for the Constitution and for constitutional fidelity and textualism. And now we suddenly have conservatives starting to agitate that they're not happy with the Constitution either. And my concern is that people out there in the middle, the people who aren't, part of these debates that we have, will look around and say, now no one is happy with the Constitution. And so why should I care about constitutional fidelity one way or the other? And the left also wants to change the Constitution, I think, more than we do. I think that's kind of obvious as well. And you go to books like Daniel Lazzari's The Frozen Republic, which I might read offensive quotes from later, because there's so much literature on the left that we don't tend to read on the right that is just fascinated with the idea of unraveling our constitutional structure. Third, ratification of amendments, however they're proposed, is very easy to stop. And that means that the effort is very likely to fail. And that means that allocating scarce political resources toward changing the Constitution is very risky, because the downside risk of simply not achieving the objective is so high, you're likely to waste resources. And if the decision is, should we try to win U.S. Senate seats that are so important to shaping our courts, or should we follow this new Article 5 convention path? I think there's a real argument that we'd be better off paying attention to Senate elections. Fourth, the process is entirely uncertain, and I'm sure we'll get into this quite a bit. It's never been done. We've never had an Article 5 amendment convention, and that means there's no precedent. There's lots of research. There's lots of things we can look to. But there are many things we can look to understand what the Commerce Clause was supposed to mean as well. The idea that good originalist scholarship will cabin what politicians and judges do with an Article 5 convention, it just doesn't make any sense. It clashes with reality. Finally, the fifth point, constitutionalism is what matters most. The parchment barriers in the Constitution are just that, unless the people are dedicated to preserving them. And ultimately, that is the problem we have. And I fear that this is not the solution to that problem. Dave,
Yep. Okay. Yeah, we were getting pretty close, Trent, to me, given the 30-second flag on...
Let it go with that.
Okay. Bill?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay. The cross-examine component to what Trent just said.
Well, I'd like to actually take the cross-exam and just, I think my opening remarks basically give my points in cross-examination.
Okay.
And just read what I've written, because I think I respond to his response already.
Okay.
So I'm just going to read it. First, I want to thank Mr. Dave Campbell for agreeing to sponsor this debate about the Article 5 convention on his program. I also wish to thank my opponent, Mr. Trent England, for taking time from his busy schedule to debate this important national issue. This debate centers on questions my opponent raised in a recent interview about a convention. Mr. England used the incorrect term of constitutional convention, unquote, to describe the convention process in that interview. This is not entirely unexpected. While Mr. England has certainly experienced much in his 36 years, he has only recently discovered the convention. Hence, errors are to be expected. In contrast, I've been involved in the movement since Mr. England was approximately 14 years old. I will not dwell further on my opponent's youth and inexperience. Like Mr. England, I am a conservative. Unlike him, however, I am not satisfied with the usual conservative mantra of asking questions about an issue, such as an Article 5 convention, but failing to provide answers. Mr. England says liberals will take over the convention and therefore a convention should not be held. The public record demonstrates the agenda of the convention is and will be overwhelmingly conservative. He says the government must obey the Constitution, then urges the Constitution be disobeyed by the government by not calling a convention. Public record refutes Mr. England on all of his positions. Indeed, within the time constraints of this debate, I will demonstrate every question asked by Mr. England and others has already been answered by the courts, the text of the Constitution, or by the founders. Today, I must admit I'm embarrassed to say I'm a conservative. The movement is led by persons who are either too arrogant, they will not listen, or so blind, they will not learn. As will be demonstrated, conservatives have developed the fatal habit of not thinking for themselves or checking out statements made about an issue. In none of this are the liberals to blame. Why should they involve themselves? There is no need. As will be proved tonight, conservatives have shown themselves more than capable of shooting themselves in the foot, far worse than any liberal could accomplish. Who, for instance, would support a political candidate who says he seeks an office charged with preserving the Constitution, but runs on a party platform, which in the summer of 2012 urged its members, both in and out of the government, not to obey the Constitution? With such a consistent position of logic, all the liberals need do is simply be silent and allow the conservatives to defeat themselves. Those conservatives who oppose a convention and yet say they believe in the conservative agenda are political and constitutional hypocrites. To name a few issues on the convention agenda: anti-gay marriage amendment, right to life amendment, balanced budget amendment, repeal of federal income tax amendment, federal revenue sharing with the states amendment, school prayer amendment, anti-flag desecration amendment, public funding of private schools amendment, review of Supreme Court rulings by states amendment, debt limitation amendment, reading of the Bible in public schools amendment, anti-communism amendment, school prayer amendment, posse comitatus amendment addressing illegal immigration, initiative referendum and recall amendment, and of course, anti-gun control amendment. Read the public record application from the states and then tell me that it is a liberal agenda. A true conservative does not equivocate regarding the Constitution. He does not say, I support the Constitution, but only this part of it. He obeys the Constitution, period. And if questions arise as to obeying that document, he finds answers. He finds solution. He offers results, not excuses. He resolves using whatever is necessary to accomplish. He does not belittle the opposition because of the position they assume, but like the founders, listens to them, realizing that sometimes, by working together, putting ideas from both sides as one, the problem can be resolved. He is true to his political ideals, but still respects the opposition in that he acknowledges they have as much right and have given as much thought as to their position as he has his. Therefore, he asks, how do we solve the problem instead of how do we spin doctor this to our favor? In short, he thinks more about being American than scoring political debating points. And above all, a true conservative, when asked why we must hold a convention, reminds the questioner that we all belong to the least exclusive club with the highest paying dues, the United States of America. The states have applied. The Constitution demands a convention.
Terrific. Okay. Thank you so much, gentlemen. What I would like to do now is, based on the five questions, I will pose a question to Trent, and then we'll let the discussion over the questions commence from that point. Trent, you make reference to the number two point, which is playing into current liberal dialogue. So my question is, with the country, at least in my view, currently at a crossroads, neither party has distinguished themselves for the last 100 years. So my question is, why why not a debate? Whether it's liberal or conservative, why not a discussion among thinking Americans?
Well, I think the premise of the question is bizarre. I mean, I haven't done opposition research on Bill, so I'm not going to get into the kind of ad hominem attack that he tried to use at the beginning of his statement. But it almost seems like an admission of defeat at the beginning. But I spent the last 7 or 8 years traveling around, thousands of miles, educating people from high school students up to World War II veterans about the Constitution. It was, 10 years ago or so that I wrote on Article 5, actually, as well as another clause for the Heritage Guide to the Constitution. I closed my 5 points talking about constitutionalism.
Right.
And discussing the Constitution is critical. And having this debate is outstanding. It's not only about the Constitution, it's also about prudence and about the fact that not every disagreement over tactics and strategy is a disagreement over principle, which Bill seems to conflate.
Well,
I think we should have a discussion. Bill seems to suggest that we shouldn't have a discussion, that if you don't agree with his point of view, you are somehow illegitimate. I think that is the end of learning, not the beginning.
All right. Well, let's take a step back, Trent. You mentioned that, the discussion on Article 5 is leading into a liberal dialogue. It supports their discussion.
Okay, and that's true. And I rushed through that point, although I think I rushed through all my points. But I think the problem is, right, Bill talks about constitutional fidelity. I talk about constitutional fidelity. And what he doesn't address, and the question I have, these are questions I have. I think these are things we need to think seriously about, is the impression that we give to the general public who does not sit around, reading the U.S. reports and the opinions of the attorney generals and doing all this research, when all of a sudden you have conservatives saying, we need to rewrite huge swaths of the Constitution. I hadn't actually realized how many amendments Bill wants, changing things that the Supreme Court is actually interpreting correctly. I was prepared to make a lot of arguments out of Federalist 49 and 50, but I think we should go right to the end in 85 and look at the admonition about trying to erect these parchment barriers one after another, to the point where you can't list enough things, right? If government is that out of control, so that's my concern, is that we give the impression to ordinary Americans that nobody likes the Constitution anymore, that the whole thing, is up for grabs. And I think that does play into the other side's hands. If we're about constitutional fidelity, it's very important that the leading edge of our message be just that, right? The Constitution is a good document. It's the greatest Constitution ever written. It survived for over 200 years. And, it's one thing to come out and say it would be better if we added this or added that or took out the 17th Amendment. I think that would be a great reform. But to say, we need 20 amendments to the Constitution, I think does play perfectly into the hands of people like Daniel Lazare, who would love to rewrite the whole thing.
Okay, Bill?
Well, first of all, Mr. England fails to realize that this stuff he talks about with the court rules and so on and so forth is rather significant. The Supreme Court has ruled 4 times that the Constitution must be obeyed, that there must be a convention call if 2/3 of the states apply. They have never set any terms or conditions ever in the history. Neither has the United States government. In the lawsuit mentioned earlier in 2006, the Solicitor General of the United States, under requirements of federal law, mandated, stated, and accepted the fact that it is correct as to fact and law to state that the applications are based and the action of Congress is based on a simple numeric count of appliance dates with no terms and conditions. The Supreme Court has stated at least four times, such as, for example, in Hawk v. Smith in 1920, Lesser v. Garnett, 1922, Hollingsworth v. Virginia, it has addressed the issues of federalism and the questions surrounding a convention. But more importantly, I want to correct one thing. These are not my amendments. These are not my suggestions. I am reporting what the states have asked for in their amendments. Now, the applications are such that Congress is obligated to call when two-thirds of the states apply. That is the constitutional side. But it is the political side, and this is where Mr. England, I think, goes astray, is he doesn't understand. It's going to be both. It's going to be just like Congress. There's going to be the constitutional side of proposing amendment. But the political discussion is going to be the resulting debate between liberals, conservatives, call them whatever you want. And all of these things that have been sitting on the agenda, and it is because Congress has refused to obey the constitutional side that they are sitting on the agenda. So will there be 20 amendments proposed? No. There'll be whatever the political resolution comes. And since you're dealing with such high numbers, you're going to have work with liberals, or conservatives are going to have to work with each other, or liberals are going to have to work with conservatives, however you want to put it, to get that kind of number, to get it out of a convention and then passed. Now, that's just the way it was set up.
Bill, can I ask you a question, though? I mean, I know there are disputes over whether you can have a limited convention. You seem to be saying that you can't have a limited convention, and that Congress, and I know there are questions over the convention call. Just for clarity's sake, is your position that Congress, that because you have reached the threshold, even though the topics are different, that Congress should have called a convention by now?
Lesser v. Garnett, 1922, right from the United States Supreme Court. The character of an amendment shall have no bearing on the amendment process. Also repeated in United States v. Sprague, 1931. There is no addition, interpolation, or rules of construction in Article 5, meaning, and they specifically stated it out because they referred to the proposal process of the Constitution and did not exclude the convention, meaning that there is a numeric count of applying states irrespective of it. The Congress has stated it itself. It has been stated by the founders on May 4, 1787. It was stated in 2006. In other words, for 235 plus years, the United States government has held the exact position. It is a numeric count of applying states. Now, that is the constitutional. That causes it to be called the political side. The idea of persons like Mr. England, Mr. Campbell, maybe somebody on the left like Lawrence Lessing, so on and so forth, seek and become delegates. They have great big argument politically.
Bill, can we go back to, I'm still not clear on, is your position, and I know you've done a great service.
Let's clarify that once and for all. It is not my position. I am reporting what the United States Supreme Court, the founders, and the other public record states. It's not my position. My position on it is not, I don't have one.
Supreme Court states it's a numeric count. Should Congress have called a convention by now? That's my question.
Yes, they should have called it as of March 13th, Friday, March 13th, 1908.
So your position is that and it is your position. You just made that abundantly clear. You say that since 1908, Congress should have called a convention, and you're claiming that there are all these court decisions after that. And yet the court has never issued a writ for Congress to call a convention, or issued a writ for a convention to be called regardless of Congress. And you're drawing from cases that reference this, but don't actually take your position, or I suppose they're not actually on this issue squarely. Right?
But what they were litigating this Congress question. Was.
All right. Well, let's.
So the practical position of the U.S. government is that is exactly the opposite. Congress's position, if you went and asked them why they haven't called a convention, they would say those convention calls are issue specific, and we tally them up in an issue specific way. And you can say that everyone else disagrees with that. That proves my point, right? Which is that all of history and law.
Trent, let me read you from a source that's irrefutable and impeachable. Congressman Madison, the same James Madison that wrote Article 5. that he had doubts, but that the House was inclined to treat the present application with respect. But he doubted the propriety of committing it because it would seem to imply that the House had a right to deliberate upon the subject. This, he believed, was not the case until 2/3 of the state legislature concurred in such application, and then it is out of the power of Congress to decline complying.
Bill, I'm not just...
Debates of Congress, March 5th, 1789.
I'm not...
I wrote it. If he says that it's an American count, it's an American count. And in that same entry, several other congressmen, all members of the convention, members of Congress, all state the same thing. It's an American count of house of state. Bill, it's not my opinion. I wasn't around in 1789.
You entirely, though, misunderstand. I'm not disagreeing with you on the way things should work. But the way things have worked, as you say, by your own scholarship for over a century, is the opposite, right? Which gets to my point, which is that you and I can agree on the way things should work. But I live in the real world where Congress for over 100 years hasn't called a convention, right? Which makes me skeptical that everything else that you and I might agree on or might not about how a convention should work will actually control how a convention does work, because for over 100 years, Congress hasn't called a convention.
They weren't called on the carpet about it until I filed the lawsuits in 2000. In the 200 plus years with all those experts, not one of them ever went to anything in the federal courts or any place else and said, okay, what is the standards for a convention call?
But what was the outcome of your suit?
The United States government agreed the following. Give me a second to double check to
what is the
convention call? You ask what you say. I'll read it. The call is peremptory. Therefore, there is no excuse Congress can offer. It is based on a merit count of applying states with no terms or condition. A sufficient number of states had already applied to cause a convention call. Congress is in violation of federal criminal law for not calling a convention.
Bill, what are you reading?
I'm reading the conclusions and the statements made in the Supreme Court in Walker v. Members of Congress and acknowledged and agreed to as correct as to fact and law by the Solicitor General of the United States, acting in his official capacity as Solicitor General and as Attorney of Record for the Congress of the United States in Walker v. Members of Congress.
Well, you're reading from briefs, right? Not from court opinion.
I'm reading from the brief, and I'm reading what the United States said was correct as to fact and law. Under Rule 15.2 of the Supreme Court, which is a federal law, if I were incorrect in what I asserted in my certiorari before the court, even before the court decides if they're going to accept it, the United States is mandated by law, not optional, mandated to point it out. They did not. Period. The law says they have to. They didn't. There is no interpretation of that rule that comes directly from the Supreme Court, and it applies to every time somebody goes up. They assert something, the other side, if it's wrong, has to tell the court they say it's wrong and why.
You're talking about merits briefing, and you just said yours was a writ of certiorari. It's hard for me not to feel like you're trying to mislead people. You're reading from briefs, and running through it so quickly, you're trying to imply, at least I have the impression that you're trying to imply to people listening, that you're reading from court opinions. I'd like to know the outcome in your case. I do know the outcome in your case, but I think it'd be great for you to say what the outcome was in your case, because what you were asking the court to do is not what the court did, right?
The court denied the certiorari based on the decision of the district court, which ruled that Coleman v. Miller had authority in the case, which states that the Congress of the United States, in all cases, based on its actions in the Civil War, where it used military force to overthrow state legislatures and cause the ratification of an amendment, the 14th Amendment, that was entirely constitutional and acceptable under the political question doctrine. That's what they ruled.
So they ruled against you?
No, they ruled in favor of the Congress having dictatorial powers over the entire amendment process.
Well,
that is exactly and expressly what the government asked. That is exactly what was done.
And again,
you asked for what they did.
Again, Bill, you and I can agree on how the world works. It should work, right? But it just, I'm not. You're beginning to make me wonder whether you live in the real world, right? The real world is the world where the Supreme Court denied certiorari in your case, right?
But Trent,
as you and I both know, denying certiorari does not make a ruling. It merely affirms the lower courts, which in this case was the District Court of the Western District of Seattle, of Washington State. They do not. Just because you don't get a certiorari doesn't mean there wasn't a ruling made. The ruling was made in the District Court. It went through the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where a trial was held, and then it finally ended up at the Supreme Court that denied cert after the government had admitted, because it finally had to, that the what I've read was correct as a fact in law.
The rules that you read, my understanding is, do not apply to a writ of certiorari. That's not merits briefing in the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think the Solicitor General's briefing on the issue of whether the court should hear the case or not, I don't know. It doesn't strike me as being dispositive. But I think the whole point, right? Again, I'm not disagreeing with you about how it should work. And I take it that you are with me believing that a convention is basically plenary. When a convention is called, it has constitutional authority.
Have references that say I'm wrong on Rule 15.2, the rules of the debate require that you present the actual references. Now, I'm going with the federal law, which was stated at the time, Rule 15.2 in the Supreme Court. If you've got that I'm wrong, then bring the references that say so. If it is not an American count of states, then there has to be a ruling, a public statement somewhere.
As you said, the ruling from the District Court, which survived appeal, went against you. And whether we like it or not, that's the most recent ruling in a case in what I think is the only case that's actually squarely on this issue, right? And it went against you.
Then you have to accept the fact that it used Coleman v. Miller, and that Congress exclusively, entirely, and I'm quoting from Coleman v. Miller, 1939. Controls the entire amendment process, and the states have nothing to do with it. And Coleman v. Miller affirmed that the Congress of the United States can literally walk into, and did in 1868, walk into the state legislatures, remove the state legislatures by military force, replace them with people of their own choosing, and get a ratified amendment.
I don't have to agree that that's the way things should work. I do have to agree that that is what the court actually said. But again, we obviously agree on that as well.
All right. So let's kind of change gears here a little bit, gentlemen. There's been, and rightfully so, there's been some discussion around the lack of what the rules of a convention are. So, Bill, I'm going to throw the question over to you. What would a convention structure look like?
In summation, based on the Supreme Court rulings, it would be essentially look just like Congress. The Supreme Court has ruled in Gulf v. Ellis, for example, 1891, Hollingsworth v. Virginia, 1798, Lesser v. Garnett, 1922, United States v. Sprague, 1931, Hawk v. Smith, 1920, Marbury v. Madison, and several other Supreme Court decisions, that the following principles are clear. The president shall have no part in the amendment process, so it can't be controlled by legislation. Hollingsworth. Delegates will be elected. Hawk and Trent, 18 U.S.C. 601, federal law. The elected delegates and members of Congress form a legal class as to their function. So far as the amendatory process is concerned, it is identical and ends under the 14th Amendment, quoting Gulf. They must be equally treated under the law. Hence, that which applies to Congress equally applies to the convention. The states cannot control the agenda through their applications of the character of amendment proposal, shall have no effect on the amendment process, Lesser and Sprague. Any proposition regarding the Constitution must satisfy all the Constitution. Something is either not constitutional or is constitutional. Between these two points, there is no middle ground. Hence, something can be constitutional in one section of the Constitution, unconstitutional in another. Therefore, the Constitution mandates that any question about Article 5 does not have to be in Article 5. It just has to be in the Constitution. All the Constitution must and can be applied to any question about a convention. The convention basically is a committee meeting. People say they don't know how to run. There's hundreds of thousands of people that have run a committee meeting. That's exactly what it was in 1789. That is what it is, would be now. And they come across and they say, well, how are you going to run it with the rules? It's very simple. Congress has the authority in the Constitution to set its own rules. So does the convention. How are you going to have the people elected? The United States Supreme, Supreme Court has already said it's elected. There is a federal law that mandates it will be elected. That exposes it to the entire election laws of the United States already established. They're going to be elected just like they elect members of Congress.
Okay.
You take it from there and you simply continue on.
Bill, to just to be clear, you were talking, most of the cases that you cited were about ratification conventions, right?
Yes, but the key point, Trent, is this. The United States Supreme Court, let's accept two premises here. The United States Supreme Court, throughout its history, is not stupid, and they can read. So they know when they make something, if it's going to be excluded to some portion of Article 5, they have to say so. There isn't one ruling where the Supreme Court has ever said, well, this only applies to Congress, and it doesn't apply to a convention.
But that's true. That's because there's a dearth of cases about Article 5 conventions for proposing constitutional amendments. Yours being one of the only, right? So yeah. I mean, what you said is true. It's practically a tautology. There are no cases on whether the 14th Amendment extends to extraterrestrial aliens either. But I don't think that's dispositive in one way or the other.
Yes, but Gulf v. Ellis does extend it. It's Gulf v. Ellis says if they're in a group and that group has the same constitutional functions, they must be treated equally. A convention and Congress propose amendments equally. The point is this, Trent.
The fact is proposing amendments, right?
Yes, but the fact is this, Trent. You're going to have to deal with the 14th Amendment. You can't simply walk away from it and say, well, gee, Bill, that really doesn't apply. It's part of the Constitution, Trent. It's going to apply automatically to the question of an Article 5 convention. So you're either going to have to accept that it does, or you're going to have to come up with cases, references, which you have not, that say, okay, it's not. Where are your references that say specifically that what I have said is not true, that the 14th Amendment doesn't apply? Come up with something. And there isn't any. So until you come up with a reference, until you show by reference, you're just giving speculation. I'm giving you court rulings as the rules require. I could give all sorts of speculation. But the reality is these court rulings have stood. And more importantly, like I said, when required, mandated by federal law to make a response that I was incorrect, the Solicitor General of the United States waived. Now, if he hadn't obeyed federal law, he could face criminal charges himself for perjury, because we're on the real side of this theory. We're not talking about theoretical. We're talking about a real case for a real court. So if you don't, if you lie, if you say, yes, it's this, and then come back later, that's perjury on the part of the person that represents the Congress. He didn't do it. He said, okay, this is correct as to fact and law. We waive. We have no opposition or any reason to oppose. It's the way it is.
The court,
so we have to accept until somebody comes in that the court, what it said and what the government did is the way it is. Plus the fact it's only one of numerous statements by the government through 200 years of history that says the same thing.
And the statement that's dispositive is the court ruling in your case. So people should read the court ruling in your case, not the briefing. And I mean, that's kind of first year law school stuff. But to the whole question of how a convention would operate, I'm not going to be baited by this whole cite references thing, Bill. A lot of the references that you've cited they're not on point. The problem here is we've never had an Article 5 convention for proposing amendments, right? It is, unfortunately.
Yes, because the United States Congress violated its oath of office, which is a criminal offense, and refuses to call it.
Period.
The government, their own attorney, admitted it.
Personally, Bill. But the issue is, and anybody can look at this, right? Look at what the United States Supreme Court did to state senate, right? I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court I think, again, this is probably an area where all of us would agree, right? Emanations from penumbras, from the 14th Amendment, in Roe versus Wade, there are all kinds of areas of Supreme Court case law that completely misinterpret and abuse the text of the Constitution. So the idea that somehow in this one little area, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to consider themselves bound to decide disputes that arise over an Article 5 convention, bound by precedent and by the and by the intent of the founders. I wish that was true. But if that was true, we wouldn't be having this conversation, because no conservative would be talking about changing the Constitution. We're here having this conversation because the courts have gone astray. Congress has gone astray. And you're talking about going to a process that requires Congress to act, which they have not done. And when they do act, they could certainly, you know, your argument.
Let's get the record corrected. They are acting. The matter of counting the applications is currently before the two judiciary committees, was brought by Dan Marks of the state of Hawaii over a year ago. It is in committee and it's being moved on. So I'm afraid they are counting. The request of one human being coming up to them and saying, what's the count you officially got, has caused them to start to count the applications.
So fine. I mean, there's no official action until they actually do something, right? I mean, they, you know.
Well, I would say this. The Speaker of the House was the one that introduced it to the Judiciary Committee. So I would say that's official action. He doesn't have to, and he did. It's in the congressional record.
But that does not at all, right? I mean, your argument, again, is that since 1908, they have been in violation of the Constitution by not calling a convention, right? And the argument I was about to make is that what guarantee do we have after 106 years of them violating the Constitution in one way, according to your argument, that when they actually call a convention, they won't violate it in the other way and try to meddle in the convention process, right? I mean, which is, people should look at the text of Article 5, right? Congress has to call the convention, and that is one of the first areas that gets people nervous. What will Congress try to do when they call the convention? And beyond that,
Hollingsworth, they can't do anything. They can't do a single thing because of Hollingsworth, 1798. The president shall have no part of the amendment process. To pass anything to control a convention requires a law or legislation or a resolution. To do that by the Constitution requires consent of the president, and the president shall have nothing. So your answer is they will do nothing because they can't. Earliest ruling in the entire thing is that the court of the United States, the Supreme Court, separated legislative law from amended law.
Bill, you spent time at the beginning of this debate making the argument that it was absolutely clear that Congress has a ministerial duty to count up the number of convention calls, and when it reaches the operative number, that they have a ministerial duty to call a convention, and then you admitted that they haven't done that since 1908. Now you're arguing that they have a clear duty not to do anything in the convention call.
The United States has ruled, the United States Supreme Court, in several rulings, Martin Lessie's being one of many back in the 1800s, is that the words of the Constitution must be taken in their full value. A call is not a law. It is not a resolution. It is not a bill. It is a call. It is a separate constitutional function of Congress. They are required to do it. They do not and cannot apply the legislative powers of Article 1 to Article 5. They're forbidden by constitutional language and by Supreme Court rulings. By the way, if that was going to be, if your argument was correct, by law, the Solicitor General was required to have brought it forth in Walker v. Members of Congress. If the federal law mandated, he should have said, no, Congress has the right to count them and separate them into subjects. Congress has the right to be able to legislate and control. That is all the exception to the word peremptory. He acknowledged it was peremptory, meaning there is no excuse. Those are excuses. If they were valid and it believed it, retract by law, he had to have responded and said it was not. He didn't.
I feel like I'm debating Neville Chamberlain, right? I mean, you have a piece of paper that says the way the world ought to work, and we all wish there was peace in our time. We all wish that the federal government would consider itself bound by these good precedents and bound by the intent of the founders.
Then why, Trent, did the United States Congress take Mr. Marks' request and another gentleman, Mr. John Guise, who added up the 1908 figure, and why did they take him into the Judiciary Committee and tell them both in writing that they're going to count him?
Yeah, we will see what they do, right? But again, it's 106 years late, right? I mean, your argument is 106 years of constitutional violation, and then your the other part of your argument hinges on the fact that nobody can violate the Constitution from here on out. It's not convincing to me.
Maybe not convincing, but we're not debating whether or not they'll violate the Constitution. We're finding out whether the argument here is what you said, is that the Congress of the United States, the constitutionalism, and so on and so forth, is the government. You're saying that the government should not obey the Constitution. That is your position. You're saying the Constitution should be obeyed, but let's not have the government obey the Constitution. You're yourself urging their position that you say they have, because you're turning around and saying, well, great, that's wonderful. But unfortunately, the references that I brought up, and I've yet to hear a single reference from you countering any of it, an actual reference, a public ruling, something from the Supreme Court, a public statement, anything that
I've
says,
cited to you,
okay,
I've cited
we're
to
not
you
going
your,
to do
your
X.
Denied certiorari. I've referenced your denial of certiorari a number of times. But I'm not here to play high school debating games. I'm here to talk about a serious question of not just law, but of politics and of prudence. And
well,
I, part
let's,
of the reason why
the aside the constitutional side, right, let's talk about the political side. Let me read you from the GOP summer. I mentioned it in my opening remarks. Resolution opposing a constitutional convention. Whereas an Article 5 of the Constitution of the United States authorizes the convening of a convention for proposing amendments, now frequently called a constitutional convention, quote, on the application of the legislature to two-thirds of the several states, quote, and whereas the Constitution is silent as to the qualifications of the delegates to such a convention or how or by whom they should be selected, of course, they didn't mention that, like I said, 18 U.S.C. 601, whereas the Constitution is also silent as to the agenda of a convention and sets out no way to limit the agenda of such convention. And of course, they didn't mention the fact there's the applications were in FOAVC since 2007. All they did was read them. Whereas former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Warren Burger concluded that there is no effective way to limit or muzzle the actions of a constitutional convention after it is convened, even though, of course, on our site we show that Warren Burger stated in for the public record in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that he had no problem with the convention and that he believed that it was no problem, no issue, because a constitutional convention and an Article 5 convention, in his mind, are two separate things. Where a convention would attract a multitude of individuals and special interest groups with agenda would alter our Constitution beyond recognition, sort of like the thousands and thousands of ones that have been proposed in Congress, and of course, obviously, the 27 that have been proposed. Whereas well-known Democratic members of Congress are currently advocating a constitutional convention to introduce a number of amendments that would enshrine and effectuate their liberal agenda. Yeah, well, that's their right. Whereas the Constitution of the United States is a timeless document, which by limiting the powers of government it created and guaranteeing the freedom of opportunity of citizens for whom it was created, has produced the best and most productive nation in the history of the world. Yeah, the Constitution as amended. Without amendments, there'd be no Bill of Rights. There would be no right to vote women to vote. There would be no having the other authorities and powers. There'd still be slavery in this nation. So it is the Constitution as amended that is the timeless document. Resolved that the National Republican National Committee strongly opposes the convening of a convention for the purpose of proposing amendments to the Constitution of the United States for the reason that the risk of loss far exceeds the possibility of gain from such an uncontrolled and uncontrollable proceeding, unquote. Now, you ask about politics? Well, there is a statement by the RNC in its website. You can go to it and find it. If you've got questions where it is, I will send you. But you go down to counsel's office, click that, go down about halfway of the page, look for amendment proposals or for the different committee thing. Look for summer 2012, click on it, you'll find it. Politically, the conservative movement, the RNC, has said publicly that they oppose obeying the Constitution of the United States. It is mandated there must be a call.
No.
The liberals aren't saying it. In fact, the liberals have got exactly two amendments right now, three if you count Larry Lessing, in the entire agenda.
You are way, way off base in this argument, right?
Gentlemen, we're running out of time. So what I would like to do is I would like Bill to take a couple of minutes for his closing arguments, and then Trent, I'll let you have a couple of minutes to close up.
Okay, well, the problem with the conservatives who oppose a convention is no matter how they cut, slice, or dice it, they refuse to look at the public record and accept what it states. They say they want a constitution. They believe in the constitution. They say that the constitution must be obeyed. But then they turn right around and say, but let's not obey Article 5. In other words, let's give Congress the right to veto the constitution. Well, right there, they've countered their own complete argument. Now, you can talk about it politically, constitutionally, or whatever. Sure, there should be a discussion on the various political proposals, and that's what is the difference between Trent. Trent is looking at it politically. And I'll grant you that the liberals and conservatives are not going to agree on agenda. That's the whole point of a convention. They're going to have to go out and get delegates. They're going to have to go out and get presentations. They're going to have to go out and give this nation the opportunity to consider proposals that make a difference in change. And I give him two names, two words, and he will know, maybe not everybody in the nation, but he will know that, yes, a citizen can make a huge difference in the running of a government. All I got to do to say him is two words, Tim Iman. He's from the state of Washington. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. Now, the Constitution must be obeyed. And that means that a convention must be called. Now, once it's called, then the political questions begin. But right now, if a true conservative is truly a conservative, he's on the phone to Congress and saying, okay, here's the evidence. I'm reading it right out of the thing. Why hasn't it been read? And I'll tell you exactly what you'll get. You will get them running from you. I don't care if they're your twin brother. They will run from you when you mention an Article 5 convention because they know it has to be. And now they're beginning to finally realize they got a call. The work of FOABC, publishing the amendment, the publishing the application, proving that they exist. The work of Walker v. Members of Congress, the work of Dan Marks, the work of John Geis, all these people bringing facts to the Congress. They can't refute them. So should the conservatives be sitting here trying to fight the convention, or should they be doing like Larry Lessing is? He's gone out and wasted virtually no political capital for his Citizens United Amendment. He's got it in two or three states. Now it's on the agenda. So now what's Larry Lessing doing? Well, he's read the Supreme Court rulings, and he stated publicly in 2012, you don't have to be on the same amendment subject. Okay, fine. So now he's working towards getting delegates lined up so that when the elections mandated by federal law come, he's going to be in the position to get them elected. What are the conservatives doing? Oh, they've all got to be on the same subject. And where did that come from? John Birch Society. And who does all of this idea of runaway convention and stuff come from? The John Birch Society. Okay. The John Birch Society has never given an accurate statement except that Article 5 concerns the amendment process. I could go for another hour proving it.
Okay, Bill.
To say, in our website, if you go down and read about the articles that I've written, and you go down and you look in the FAQs, you will find the written proof, including references and documentation, far more than I can tell in this few seconds, that proves the John Birch Society does not tell the truth. There was never a runaway convention, and as final proof, I'm going to make a very quick statement. 10 days after the Constitution finished its work on the amendment process and sent the Constitution to Congress, that would have been September 27th, when it presented its bill for the Constitution, it's how much it cost, which was $1,165.90, by the way. The First Amendment was proposed by Henry Lee, the first motion, that it was a runaway. Basically, he said, well, you can't do this because it's setting up a different form of a union of states. That wasn't the exact words, but that's what he stated. Now, you have to remember, this was the same Congress that proposed the applications in, the call, February. The members of that Congress, many of them were at that convention, so they were eyewitnesses.
Okay.
His motion that this thing exceeded its authority was voted down virtually unanimously by Congress. It carried one state. It had about six votes. That's all it carried. The United States government, regarding a runaway convention, resolved the question 10 days after the convention. Not 10 years, not 10 decades, not 10 weeks. 10 days.
Okay, Bill. In fairness, I've got to give Trent, the last word.
Well, thank you, Dave, for the debate, and thank you, Bill, for all your scholarship on this issue. My argument boils down to prudence, and I think part of what was great about the founders of our country, and part of what differentiates the American Revolution—part not all—but what differentiates the American Revolution from the French Revolution is that the American revolutionaries were conservative and they were realistic and they considered human nature. And the argument that Bill advances is sadly self-defeating. He and I agree on almost everything, almost, except for how the world actually works, right? Because everything that he has cited, and people should go and actually look up these cases, because most of what Bill has cited, he is reasoning from a case that was about one thing over to this area of Article 5 Amendment conventions. And that's a reasonable way to reason in the law. But it is not dispositive, not nearly as much as Bill has suggested. And we look no further than the Commerce Clause, right? We can look back and we can understand why the Commerce Clause is in the Constitution and what it was meant to do. But earlier this week, I had to write an article about the Clean Water Act and the EPA trying to extend the reach of the Clean Water Act, which is all based on the Commerce Clause, which is preposterous. And I'm sure Bill agrees with me that the courts and Congress and the executive branch have all gone astray in the way they interpret the Commerce Clause. And we would probably agree, mostly at least, on what the Commerce Clause means. So there's gray areas. These issues are hard. The founders didn't all agree on everything, and we're not all going to agree on everything, even within the conservative movement. We certainly shouldn't castigate people with whom we disagree on areas of tactics or strategy or even areas of minutia when we agree on principle. And I think that Bill and I agree on the basic principles at stake. What I am doing to try to revive our constitutional republic centers around education. The progressives won through the culture. Politics and law follow the culture.
All right.
And if we want to revive the Constitution, we have to revive it first in the hearts and minds of the American people. And I think that is far more important than tilting at the windmill, which is this particular effort toward an Article 5 Amendment Convention. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Trent. Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see everybody again. Clarity from Chaos next Monday night. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for joining Dave Campbell and Clarity from Chaos. To email Dave or hear today's show and all Clarity from Chaos shows on demand, just click on Clarity from Chaos at doublewidenetwork.com. And please join Clarity from Chaos on Facebook and Twitter. Until next week at this time, we hope you continue to navigate life's complexities by finding clarity from chaos. Yeah!